Hi, this is John Udell. My guest for today's podcast is Phil Windley. He's a computer scientist who became an e-commerce executive in the dot-com era, was then CIO for the state of Utah, and now wears a number of hats. He's the executive producer of IT Conversations, a professor at Brigham Young University, a prolific and popular technology blogger, and last but not least, the author of a book on digital identity and one of the leading authorities in that field. We got together to talk about identity issues in the real world, in the virtual world, and the relationship between the two.
Phil Windley.
Hey, Phil, this is John. How you doing?
Oh, hi, John. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. So thanks for agreeing to do this. As I mentioned in email, I've gone through a little bit of a game of identity shoots and ladders on behalf of my daughter recently because we've been moving her to an apartment. She's not yet a driver, but all of a sudden she needed a bunch of ID. So naturally, we went looking around and discovered that her passport was expired and we couldn't find her social security card. Really, it was a chance for me to kind of see through someone's eyes who's just starting out some things which I've forgotten and also some things which have changed really since the last time I went down that chute. So, you know, we were just running into identity bottlenecks everywhere we turned. We were going to be getting her a non-driver ID, which is essentially a driver's license.
With no authorizations.
Yeah.
Right. Because a driver's license has not only the authentication part, the picture, and all of the data, it also has authorizations that say you can do specific things.
Yeah. For our purposes here, I suppose it's really equivalent to getting a driver's license. And so it sort of just made me revisit the whole bootstrapping process here.
Mm-hmm.
We would have needed to provide, let me see if I've got this right, a letter from the town clerk, which would be proof of residence in the state, and then two pieces of ID, one of which had, no, there couldn't have been one that had to be a picture because that's part of bootstrapping your picture credential is getting the driver's license. And so, but a birth certificate was required. And then I think we could have used the passport if it had not been expired, or we could have used the social security card, which eventually we found.
It's a little surprising they wouldn't let you use an expired passport.
You know, this is a recent change. And I know this because I carried an expired one around for a couple of years, actually, and used it to cross the border into Canada several times. But things have ratcheted down, and people are much less tolerant of that right now, which, I mean, it's fair enough. If you're going to have a credential, it seems like it should be current, so I can't gripe about that.
It's kind of like using a digital certificate that has been revoked.
Right.
You're not sure what it means.
Exactly. Not like we don't all do it all the time, right?
Right.
So then we did, like I say, find the social security card, although I don't think that that's going to turn out to be a very important credential. The birth certificate is clearly foundational in terms of bootstrapping other things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'd forgotten about the whole distinction between a birth certificate and a certified birth certificate.
Right.
We live in New Hampshire, but she was born in Massachusetts, and so I went online, and there are a variety of different ways to request a certified copy of a birth certificate, none of which, as far as I can tell, are in the least bit secure, my impression. I mean, it just appeared to me that essentially anyone who could have done the minimal amount of research to discover the father and mother could buy one.
Right, which is why in the old days, back before IT systems were more linked, that's why identity thieves would request a birth certificate of someone who had died.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't work anymore because it turns out that states have pretty good death record databases which they share.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you go pick somebody who's died in Massachusetts and request their birth certificate, you can get it. But if you take it to Montana and try and get a driver's license with it, they'll know.
Mm-hmm.
Or likely, they should know.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure people can slip through, but
right. They
should know.
But as far as I can tell, nothing would prevent someone who wasn't me or her from requesting her birth certificate and paying for it and getting the certified copy.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay.
How did the town clerk establish residency?
Well, you know, we haven't done that piece of it yet. The chain of evidence there would be things like a lease with your signature on it.
Yeah, which is not uncommon. I mean, if you applied for food stamps, for example, that's how you'd establish certain facts, is by taking bills or whatever. And I just got a passport for my 15-year-old daughter who didn't have a driver's license yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that when I went down to the post office to do that, he just said, "Are you her dad?" "Yeah." "Can I see your driver's license?" "Yeah." "Okay."
Mm-hmm.
That was that was about the extent of applying for the passport for my daughter.
It wasn't clear to me in what circumstances she would be required to produce ID. It just was obvious that she was going to be having to do that now.
Mm-hmm.
But immediately, I started running into things. And so, for example, I went to order her a phone line, and we were just going to put it in her name. Couldn't complete that procedure because, you know, she's got no credit record, and so they wanted ID, and it was back to the same thing. Well, you know, driver's license? No, not yet. Well, what about, you know, and it was, you know, we had to sort of revisit the whole chain of evidence, which it just hadn't occurred to me, you know, for something like a telephone.
Yeah.
You know, that all of these same connected identity documents are part of the protocol. And so I just thought it would be great to talk to you, you know, given all of the things that you've done, ranging from your experience at the state of Utah and the conversations we've had about the way in which things like state driver's licenses are de facto credentials for everything. And that's even more true than probably a couple of years ago when we first had that conversation, through your, you know, all of the thinking that you've done in the book on identity that you recently published. I'm kind of looking for some perspective here because I've been around and around on all sides of this issue, and I've gone through phases where I've been a really pretty strong advocate of high-tech cryptographic credentials, and I've been through phases where I think that's just completely ridiculous. I've been through phases where I actually thought a national ID wasn't a bad idea, and through phases where I've flipped the bit on that one as well. It goes around and around. But I thought, to kind of kick things off, I found a couple of statements in Bruce Schneier's newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Identification and profiling don't provide very good security, and they do so at enormous cost. Dropping ID checks completely and engaging in random screening where appropriate would be a far better security trade-off." He says, "People who know that they're being watched are people who become scared to step out of line. People living in this kind of society are not free. It's contrary to all the ideals that went into founding the United States." So that's his argument against a national ID.
Yeah.
It's not the case that we don't have that system. We only have an extremely cumbersome and ineffective version of a national ID system. But in fact, we have one. And in fact, you are being watched very closely, right?
I guess we've both read the Brin Transparent Society book.
Yes.
I think that's a distinction he makes pretty carefully, is there's a difference between having someone be able to see what's going on and living in a surveillance society where only the police are looking, and they're looking all the time.
Mm-hmm.
As I listen to you quote Bruce's comment back, I guess I find myself agreeing and disagreeing in some certain situations, saying identity doesn't provide very good security is probably true. But I think if you take that to the extreme and say, I mean, why did the phone company want your daughter's ID? They wanted it as some sort of security.
Mm-hmm.
So if Bruce's comment is true across the board, then we shouldn't need IDs at all. Your daughter should be able to get a phone without identifying herself in any way. You know, it seems impractical. And so I think that it does provide security in certain circumstances. It's providing the phone company security because they have some reasonable expectation or some probability that that identity is correct when they take it, that credential is correct when they take it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is, then they can use that to essentially track her down if she defaults on her bills.
Mm-hmm.
And so knowing her identity does provide them with at least financial security in some way.
Yeah, sure.
Maybe Bruce is talking more about airline security, or I don't have the context. But
well, I think that is, in fact, exactly what has colored the whole debate over the last, it's now 5 years since 9/11. Here's another snippet from Schneier from a different one of his essays. He writes, "Two of the 9/11 terrorists had valid Virginia driver's licenses in fake names. Even if we could guarantee that everyone who issued national ID cards couldn't be bribed, initial cardholder identity would be determined by other identity documents, all of which would be easier to forge. Mm-hmm. Not that there would ever be such a thing as a single ID card. Currently, about 20% of all identity documents are lost per year. An entirely separate security system would have to be developed for people who lost their card, a system that is itself capable of abuse. And of course, in that category, I mean, over a period of years, we managed to lose her social security card and her birth certificate. And so, well, we found the one, but...
Yeah, every time somebody asks for my social security card, I go, oh, do I know where it is?
Right.
You know, I'm not sure I know where it is.
The debate is clearly being driven right now by the response to 9/11. And,
yeah.
And so
yeah.
I think that the thing that's hard to discuss right now in any reasonable or rational way is the kind of more routine use of identification for things like you pointed out the phone company was interested in, which is just,
right.
You know, I've never met this customer before. How can I know something about them in order to engage in a business relationship with them?
And there's at least a couple of really big distinctions between their use of identity to provide some sort of credit security versus the use of an identity system to provide fail-safe airline travel,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And one, they're willing to accept some risk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they clearly aren't foolish enough to believe that every ID someone shows them is valid,
mm-hmm.
right? And yet they didn't go through an elaborate process to screen it, I presume.
Right.
They say, okay, we've got it, it's issued by a state or whoever will accept it. And they know that there's a certain percentage of those IDs that are going to be invalid. The people are going to default and they're going to lose some money, and that's okay.
Yeah, reasonable.
Right, whereas in airline security, we don't accept any risk as okay.
Yes, absolutely right.
Yeah, and so I think that's a huge difference when you say, okay, we're going to use an identity system to provide an underpinning for commerce, versus we're going to use an identity system to keep people safe from terrorists. That's a huge difference.
Yeah, it is. It's hard to sort of untangle the threads here, but, well, let me go on with a few other examples just to continue to set the mm-hmm. stage. So I do live in New Hampshire, and New Hampshire, along with Kentucky, is one of two states that was chosen to pilot the federal Real ID Act.
Oh, lucky you.
New Hampshire, having been the first colony to declare its independence from the oppression of the Brits, and having live free or die as its state motto on the license plates of our cars, predictably rebelled. And in fact, there was a bill in the House that basically said, you know, we're not going to do it. But then after they said no, they said maybe, and the Senate overruled. And so now they're actually thinking about it, and it's unclear how that's going to land.
Mm-hmm.
But it is clearly motivated by an antipathy to the idea of a national database or a registry, which, in fact, as a matter of policy, this country has rejected explicitly mm-hmm. over, well, at least in the past. But the debate, and I was just kind of gathering some background here, the debate's been pretty interesting. Just recently in the Concord Monitor, I found this little snippet. It says, to try to separate Real ID fact from myth, Senate Majority Leader Bob Clegg organized a task force of lawmakers, state officials, and law enforcement representatives. Clegg said, residents should realize that much of their personal information is already available on the internet without Real ID. As an example, he asked State Banking Commissioner Peter Hildreth to purchase a credit report using only Clegg's name and address. Hildreth returned with the senator's social security number, residential history, and personal business records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We tacitly or implicitly accept this stuff. And so from that perspective, it's almost like the argument that we're making is, let's make this cumbersome and inefficient because that will prevent the aggregation of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to the thing that I was mentioning before of death records. Getting, you know, a fake ID by purchasing a birth certificate of someone who's dead and then trying to go to another state and get a driver's license using it, and mm-hmm. yet the states have managed to get good death records. That's not necessarily easy because it's not like you're just dealing with 50 states. There are over, I think, 2,000, 2,600, something like that, counties.
Hmm.
And in many states, all of those records are maintained at the county level.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you just get 50 records. I mean, they're all over, and they're spread out, and they're different. It's kind of like the sales tax issue, right, where there's so many different jurisdictions, and yet people have managed to do it. If people are motivated enough, you're making it difficult isn't quite enough. There's a guy at George Washington University named Daniel Solove who writes quite a bit about privacy.
I actually heard him on, I guess it was on IT Conversations, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he's actually thought a lot about this stuff. But one of the things I thought about as I was talking to him one time is that our nation has kind of made this deal. Government won't create a national ID, and we won't make them create good privacy laws. Right, and so the end result of that is people like, I'm just going to say Amazon off the top of my head. Not that I think that they are an especially egregious example of this. There are probably others, like Checkpoint, for example, or the credit agencies. There are companies with significant financial motivation to link all of this data together. And yet there are no laws at all to prevent them from doing so, from sharing it. Well, no laws at all is maybe going too far. There are very few laws that prevent them from aggregating it, from linking it, from sharing it, or even selling it back to the government.
Yeah.
Right, so the government can't create this big database. But if Checkpoint wants to create it and the government wants to buy records from it, that's okay.
Yeah. When you were the CIO at the state of Utah, was there a comparison made to the situation in countries that are more in the direction of national ID?
Yeah, that frequently came up. If you talk to people from a number of countries in Europe, they would just laugh at the idea that we don't have a national ID,
mm-hmm.
and they would be scared to death of the fact that we don't have any privacy laws.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not necessarily saying that those things are related, that if we got a national ID, we'd have good privacy laws. I don't want to make that kind of connection, but they demand good privacy, but they're not really concerned about the national ID all that much. The state of Utah, this was actually about a year before I was CIO, somebody introduced a bill to add a SIM chip to the driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
Reasonable thing to, you know, allow that data to be electronically readable and to be modifiable after the fact, which mag cards are more difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hold more data and, you know, have computers and all kinds of stuff, right? I mean, and I thought, you know, that would be a great place to put a digital certificate.
Yeah.
Have the state issue a digital certificate to everyone, put it on their driver's license.
Yeah.
Well, when this bill was introduced, what people jokingly refer to as the black helicopter crowd just came out of the closets. Right? I mean, they were everywhere.
Yeah.
This was literally going to be the thing that ushered in the fall of the state of Utah.
Mm-hmm.
There's really, really high emotion surrounding this area for many people, and yet it seems like they're kind of focused on the wrong thing. Now, they're all focused on the ID part instead of the privacy part.
Mm-hmm. What's your current feeling about the prospects for Real ID?
I've been thinking for a long time that Real ID is this end run around the national ID card debate.
Right.
Because it doesn't say we're going to have a national ID card. It just says, here are a set of criteria in which the federal government requires states to have for their driver's licenses. And, of course, once you have those, it's easy to connect those all together.
And can you summarize what those are briefly?
I don't know the exact details, but, you know, things that spring to mind are, I think this is not true anymore, but even as late as like 5 years ago, there was at least one state that didn't require a picture on the driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
You could go in and say, I don't want a picture. You know, do you list the address? Do you list date of birth? Is that on the mag stripe? Is it not? Those kinds of things. So if you take your driver's license to, you know, you're driving across the country and you go through Utah and you get pulled over, they can run your mag stripe and get certain data off of it that's mm-hmm. consistent with everybody else's data. I think one time when we had dinner, we compared your New Hampshire's driver's license to my Utah driver's license,
mm-hmm.
and there were significant differences in what data was on the cards.
Yes.
And so this really just provides that consistency so that it, you know, becomes kind of a de facto ID system.
Yes.
I think that whether Real ID becomes a reality or not, whether the federal government mandates it and it happens, it will slowly move towards what Real ID wants to be. And what I mean by that is just having been at the state level and having seen the cooperative initiatives that states put together amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's only a matter of time until driver's licenses become much more interchangeable between states. Interchangeable is maybe the wrong word, more consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Utah and I think seven other states have formed a criminal justice regional cooperation pact. Pennsylvania has done the same thing. I think there's one down by Florida. You know, and as you see these things grow, what those things do is they essentially not only do things like say, well, all driver's licenses have to have this date on them, but they also link the criminal justice networks. So when you're driving through Utah from Nevada and get stopped and show your Nevada driver's license and they run it,
yeah,
they'll actually get Nevada criminal justice data.
Yeah.
You know, which right now, I don't know about right now, but, you know, a couple of years ago was the last knowledge I had, was not possible. Right?
Yeah.
They essentially had to just make a phone call to Nevada, which wasn't very good. Whereas if you're in Utah and you show them your Utah driver's license and they run it, we pulled, you know, if you had been in prison, we'd pull all of the Department of Corrections data. Almost every piece of data we had about you was available to that trooper sitting in his car within seconds of you getting pulled over.
Yeah.
And those networks are expanding, so it won't be long before the National Governors Association comes up with some task force, if they don't already, to have a national criminal justice network where states share data.
Yes.
And so these things are going to happen just because they can.
Yeah. And I think that one of the unfortunate things right now is that no one is being told another side of the story about high-tech credentials. Let's just grant that, like every other kind of credential, high-tech credentials are vulnerable to forgery and
mm-hmm,
misuse.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also vulnerable to the inability of people to figure out how to use them, because that's just one of the great unsolved problems. But here's the thing about the story that's not being told relative to your point about privacy, is that in principle, it should be possible to exercise selective disclosure of
mm-hmm.
attributes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, well, I know that in the sort of mainstream discussion about high-tech identity cards, that this point never comes up. I think that the popular notion is that, well, you know, this thing is linked to all of your data, and anyone who touches that credential is going to scoop up all of your data and have access to all of it. And no one's going out of their way to show that, in fact, one of the opportunities here is to disclose selectively, so that if you show up at the liquor store, and in fact, the only thing you need to prove is your age and, well, residence, I guess, then those attributes can be selectively disclosed to that entity without it having access to other information that's on the card.
Yeah, not even necessarily your age, just a yes or no.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. I suppose that we technologists, are probably to blame for not articulating that aspect of the debate.
I think you're right. I think people kind of think of this digital certificate as something that contains all their data, as opposed to just an identifier with some data that could be selectively disclosed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you talk about linking, and that's actually something I've thought a lot about lately in the context of reputation systems, which I've got a couple of students who are working on some research in that area. It's interesting that there's a huge tension between reputation and privacy,
mm-hmm.
because reputation is based on linking data.
Mm-hmm.
Your reputation is based on the fact that your name is on your website and
mm-hmm.
you use your name to write for
mm-hmm.
InfoWorld and various other things you've done, right? If you'd created a pseudonym, done all of that, and then called me up and said, "Hi, I'm John Udell," I'd go, "Yeah, and who are you?"
Mm-hmm.
Right? So your reputation is directly tied to linking all of that stuff together.
Yes.
And yet your privacy is, right, the more you do that, the less privacy you have.
Yes.
I actually picked up a couple of books recently about how to be invisible. Right, there's a book by J.J. Luna called How to Be Invisible.
You wrote about that. I saw that.
And how accurate their tips are, I have no idea. I certainly wouldn't vouch for them because I don't have any personal knowledge of having done it. But it's interesting that if you want privacy, and this is not just online, right? They're talking about in the real world. The thing that they talk about in every situation, every tip has to do with delinking data.
Yeah.
To make, even to the point of not ever giving anyone your home address.
Yeah.
And how you can do that, right? All the tips are about how can you avoid giving your home address. And some of it's just, there's no way most people would go through the inconvenience of what it would cost to delink that data in the physical world. And I think the same thing's true online. Most people are willing to link data and give up privacy in exchange for the convenience of buying things from Amazon or having a credit record and, you know, all the other things that you need in order to get along in today's world.
Yes. But we've, and again, this is kind of the royal we technologists have mm-hmm. failed pretty badly to present any options for selective disclosure. And so another example that I ran into recently, the case where I was interested in signing up for a peer-to-peer lending and borrowing service called mm-hmm. Prosper. It's an extremely interesting kind of thing. And what stopped me was I just didn't want them to stick my social security number in their database. Mm. I mean, you know, I know it's lots of other places, but lately, as an exercise, I just ask people, well, is there a way around that? Because in fact, you know, what do they need it for? Well, they need it to run credit checks, but they only do that occasionally, and it doesn't have to happen in real time. So my notion was, well, why shouldn't you flow your request through me? Yours is signed by you. It flows through me. I attach a copy of my social security number, mm-hmm. which is encrypted to Equifax, along with a permission for you to, you know, for them to use it once, right? And it arrives mm-hmm. there and is used once by them. And, you know, I'd have to trust them to only use it once and so on. But obviously, it's hard enough to get the simple basics working correctly. So you start to imagine these fancier protocols, and it's even more of science fiction to imagine them working properly, I suppose.
Yeah.
But still, you know, I had a
similar experience recently. I took my my son to the orthodontist to have wisdom teeth out.
Mm-hmm.
The patient's sign-in sheet had a place for social security number.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, should I write that down? I said, no. And I went up to the lady and I said, do you need a social security number? Why do you need it? Because I'm kind of the same way. I always ask, what do you... And she says, oh, we don't need that anymore. We don't use it. It used to be that it was part of the insurance stuff, but but it's still on your form. How many dozens of people every day probably fill that out, write their social security number on it, even though they don't even care anymore?
Yes.
And you're right. The selective disclosure, I mean, it's even compounded by the fact of, you know, unnecessary disclosure that people ask for.
Yeah.
There's been some conversations recently in the identity community surrounding what I've called identity rights agreements, and other people have had other names for. But the idea is a simple way to mark up your identity data, at least online, or when it shows up in XML or HTML.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's certainly not the whole world, but, you know, it would be a way for you, when you transmit some identifying data in XML, to, in a fine-grained way, say, this piece of data, like your name, I don't care if you use, keep in your database, whatever,
mm-hmm.
this piece of data, which is my social security number, you have my permission to use once and destroy,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, so on and so forth. And some of the debates that have taken place at the identity workshops that we've had and other things have been pretty interesting. You know, because you talk about how complicated this could become, and I've had people ask me, well, what's the difference between identity rights agreements and something like the P3P?
Right.
Part of the difference is that P3P was specifically about web pages, whereas this is more about specific identity data. But another big difference that we talked about was keeping it simple, keeping it more like Creative Commons, where there's, what, 6 or 7 choices, as opposed to 300 or 500 or however many choices there are with some more complicated things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's critical, because, you know, if you talk about selective disclosure, and some things could certainly be automated, like when you're a liquor store example. You know, there's no reason I even need to know that it's happening. But
yes.
But other cases, I may need to choose how I want my data disclosed. And if I've got, you know, a drop-down menu with a few choices, I probably can navigate that. But if I've got a complicated matrix, I probably will just go, I don't know, and check whatever the default is.
Yeah, yeah. Although this presumes that we're to a point where people are routinely exchanging XML formatted packages of identity data, and of course, essentially no one is. And what's more, a whole bunch of people think that it would be really bad if we got to the point where that was happening in the first place.
We're not exchanging XML formatted identity data, but I'm sending identity data through web forms quite a bit.
Yeah.
Right, which isn't XML formatted, but it's formatted data that's getting exchanged.
That's
certainly
true.
I could tie, you know, identity rights to to that data.
That's actually a really good point. In a way, it's probably more relevant to more people than P3P is.
You know, and it's not going to solve the world's problems, but it's, you know, I think the conversation is interesting that we can at least start to talk about how could we mark up identity data so that, I mean, right now, even if Amazon or someone else wanted to treat my data in specific ways and wanted to honor my requests, there's no way for me to communicate that to them.
Yes. That's actually a fantastic idea because no one is going to read a privacy policy, as we know, never mind try to compute the implications.
Right.
Theoretical implications.
Or the intersection of their privacy policy with this other policy. I mean, it's just impossible.
Yeah, yeah. But if we had some kind of a branded look and feel related to some simple microformat kind of markup that could be applied to forms and people got the idea, you know, if you got that meme out there into the popular consciousness in just some really simple ways that there are these few basic choices and people start to have an expectation that they will indicate what their preferences are in, you know, like you said, a really short menu of choices.
Mm-hmm.
That would actually be a huge step in the right direction. And not even so much for the particular problem that it would or wouldn't solve, but more because it would get people thinking about things as aggressive or informed consumers
mm-hmm.
of services that are making use of their identity data and give them a sense of that they should expect control and that they can have, hopefully can have some.
Yeah. The discussions are happening, whether it turns into anything real, you know, we're both technologists, we've been around, and these things, you know, go different ways, but It's an interesting discussion.
Well, I suppose we can't do this experiment because we'll never know how things would have turned out 5 years after 9/11 if it hadn't happened. But had that not happened, do you think we'd, by 2005 or 6, be in a pretty different place?
That's a really tough question. I don't know if we'd be in a different place. I mean, I think that you're right. The debate would be different, right? We wouldn't be having all of these. You know, a lot of things wouldn't have happened. And some of those, even though they might have been bad policy, and, you know, like I'm thinking of, you know, Poindexter's, some of Poindexter's projects. While they were bad policy, I think the debate that they engendered was probably healthy.
Mm.
It probably educated people to ideas they hadn't thought about before.
Mm.
And so in that sense, maybe we're ahead in the sense that there's at least more discussion happening. Yeah, I think when, you know, I contrast that to Schneier's statements you were reading earlier.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I found when I was CIO is that the law enforcement types that I was involved with, and, you know, these are not just, you know, new cops on the beat. These are guys who have been in law enforcement for their whole life, very smart, you know, running the entire state public safety division, for example. They are very, very interested in security and keeping things safe. They, you know, everybody that I knew, they were good guys. They wanted to do a good job,
mm-hmm.
but they were, I would say, without exception, they were not very. They didn't place much faith in IT or in the ability of technology to help solve their problems.
Can you blame them?
no, not necessarily, right? But they don't think like that.
Yeah.
They all came up as they were cops on the beat sometime, right? And they put their faith in the stuff that solved cases, going and talking to people, and, you know, kind of stuff that we'd consider, you know, real old fashioned police work. And I think that we don't do a good job of helping them understand the ways the technology can be used to do their job.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they are forced in a situation, like TSA is probably a good example, where they have to rely on technology to do their job,
mm-hmm.
they aren't particularly well informed.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm sure TSA has some great technologists working for it, but they probably aren't the people making the decisions. You know, they're not making the policy. They might get consulted. And,
mm-hmm.
and so the people who are making these policies are people who probably don't really trust technology very much.
Mm.
And I think that that's partly our fault, partly their fault. You know, I remember an incident where I sat down, this was right after 9/11, and we were trying to brainstorm every way that we might be able to to use the state IT infrastructure in order to increase security.
Yeah.
States have wonderful geographic databases, and Utah had a great group that was doing this. And I remember pulling the head of the Department of Public Safety and a few of his lieutenants in and saying, what if Deer Creek Reservoir broke, which is a dam not far up the canyon here? And he says, well, you know, and he starts talking. He said, would it be helpful to you if we could show you where the water would go?
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say, oh, yeah, that'd be really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And we showed it to him, and he says, that's pretty cool. I said, how about if I showed you which fire stations and police stations are no longer operable? Wow, that'd be neat. You know, you push a button, they're all, you know, little red dots show up. How about all the hospitals you can no longer use? Wow, that's a good idea. How about the toxic waste dumps that are now inundated? Wow. You know, because we have all of that data.
Yeah.
It had never crossed their minds
yeah.
that we might be able to show them this stuff
yes.
ahead of time before the event.
Yes.
And, you know, and that's just one small example of how I don't think we do a great job of helping the people who are making policy decisions make good decisions. And we sit on the sidelines and throw rocks at them, and sometimes deservedly so, right? But then we all just kind of go back to our jobs of, you know, programming or whatever and say, well, you guys, we'll throw rocks at you next time you just say something stupid.
Yeah, that's a great point. It actually just occurred to me another factor which is now seeping into the popular consciousness is the outcome of that AOL data spill.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to this point about linking and delinking and being invisible or not. I think it gave everyone pause, even those of us who kind of already knew that that's how things work. And it actually was quite interesting because it didn't get nearly as much press. But in that same week, Google also made a data release for research purposes. And in their case, it was in some ways it was similar, right? It was their Ngram database, right? So just kind of, you know, the frequency of sets of terms. It wasn't exactly comparable, but I mean, the key thing was that there was no identity and no chronology in it. And you know, as the AOL case made plain, even a disguised identity when matched to a chronology is incredibly revealing. You know, it sort of takes you back to David Brin. At some point, you have to kind of realize either I am going to be off the grid or we're all going to be naked,
mm-hmm.
which is better than only some of us being naked.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, taking yourself off the grid is, you know, for some people, maybe it's possible, but I just don't see how I could live my life without, and I'm not just talking about being on the internet, you know, just everything.
Yeah.
Just credit, you know, all the services that we take for granted every day.
Yeah.
I think the world of physical credentials offers some analogies of how things could roll out and if we all just kind of go with the default. If you think about your great-grandfather, your great-great-grandfather, they probably didn't have any credential whatsoever. You know, if their birth was recorded, it was probably in the family Bible. Yeah, they would, if someone would have stopped them and say, prove you're John Windley, he would have said, what do you mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole idea wouldn't have even necessarily made any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think it's been a couple of years ago now, but, you know, the Supreme Court ruled that you can't refuse to show identity documents to a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
We've gotten ourselves as a society to the point where identity credentials are not just, you know, prevalent in society, but you actually don't have the right to say, no,
mm-hmm.
I won't identify myself when asked by properly constituted authority. And I'm certainly not a lawyer, but you know, that's a huge change in how the world works.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of come about by default. And I think largely without anyone saying, oh, this is the way the world ought to be. I think it happened in large part as an aid to commerce. And even that was sometimes done without much forethought. You know, driver's licenses became the de facto identity document, even though states didn't necessarily want to be in the identity business. But think about what commerce would be like if the government hadn't provided a foundational identity document.
I don't know where your grandfather or his father was from, but if your great-grandfather, who probably never went more than 25 miles from the
mm-hmm.
spot where he was born, was one of the relatively few people who traveled overseas and was trading in another country than, you know, there likely would have been documents. I mean, there certainly would have been, right? I mean, people mm-hmm. had letters of reference and you know, yeah. ways of conveying assurances of identity over distance, because it's, you know, and that really hasn't changed.
Yeah, just the methods by which we do it have changed. And I think the level of assurance that people get. I mean, you know, if your identity document consisted of some letters of reference from people who we both knew in common, unless I was really going to take the time to check out that, you could forge it. There's lots of different ways you could do it. Probably easier than now, right? There was probably lots of fraud that we have since done away with by better identity documents, only to have discovered new ways of doing fraud, right? We certainly haven't done away with it, but we've changed the nature of it by changing the nature of the identity credentials. And, you know, we've got this foundation, the government has provided this foundational identity document, and, you know, modulo the discussion we had about, you know, airline security earlier, it actually has worked pretty well. And most people, I think, are pretty comfortable with, I've got a driver's license, I've got a credit score, and, you know, all of those things. They kind of, you know, it's the way the world works, and they're not horribly uncomfortable with it. It's when we transfer that to the online world that people start thinking, oh, what are the ramifications of this? And, you know, if we don't think about it ahead of time, it will develop in a de facto way. And I think people will be comfortable with it just because that's the way it is. It may not be the best world we could imagine, however.
You know, your point about the letters of reference being easily forgeable mm-hmm. can be countered by saying that, in some sense, if those letters were from people that we really did know and know well, it's actually quite conceivable that they could be less forgeable than mm-hmm. a modern identity document, just because they would draw on shared private knowledge.
Yeah.
And
that's true.
And because the unique signature, if you will, not just signature in terms of your John Hancock, but the sort of the, you know, the pattern, you know, the style of people's use of language,
yeah,
either in writing or especially, of course, in speech, is in the primordial sense. You know, that's how organisms identify one another, right? You know, we mm-hmm. do this kind of incredibly sophisticated automatic pattern recognition, and we can identify somebody 100 yards away because of how they're walking, even if we can't see their face, you know, all sorts of, you know, cues in people's voices and facial expressions and things like that. And so, if we get to the point where we can establish kind of like multi-point high bandwidth communication in real time, you know, such that if in fact I called you up and you didn't know me, but I knew someone that you knew and I got that person on the line and they happened to be available, like we would quickly, I think, establish my identity more reliably than any credential, low tech or high tech, probably, that I could ever present to you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. And establish your, not just your identity, but you'd actually transfer reputation data.
Yes.
Right? When someone who I trust introduces someone else and says, oh, you've got to talk to this person because they did X, Y, and Z, and I think you need to talk to them about, you know, W.
Yeah.
That means a lot more to me than if I just saw their ID badge at a conference.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? And that's the reality of it. And so I guess part of my line of thinking here is that we're going to have all these debates about credentialing and high tech and low tech credentials, but then kind of growing up around and in between all of that stuff is going to be this increasingly rich kind of social network that we're all building and spending more of our time in, and through which we can convey these kinds of personal assurances, perhaps in increasingly natural ways that at first won't serve any legal purpose necessarily, but you know, in a practical way, right, in terms of the sort of the practicalities of a lot of things that we would otherwise try to apply credentials to, it might actually be a pretty nice complement or even replacement.
Yeah, that actually hits home a lot because of the work we've been doing in reputation systems.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really have great ways of transferring reputation data on the net. And part of that's because we don't have universally fungible identifiers.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to be able to link the data.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to link identifiers, you have to do something in order to do that. And with the balkanization that we've been in, So that's one of the things I look to this user-centric identity movement to maybe provide us with, is an identity platform upon which we could build some of these things. You know, and I think your point about doing it in a natural way is really interesting and probably key to making it happen.
Hmm. Well, this was fun.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for showing up. This was great.